Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Welcome to Spectrum West on a Thursday, the 10th day of October. I'm Al Ross. Today we spend some time with John Greendeer, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation, on their initiative as part of their heritage and another that's underway with UW Eau Claire. Doug Pearson is here to provide a peek at the Big Chippewa Valley Book Festival, which launches a big itinerary of events on Monday. And we have glances at three big musical events happening in your neighborhood this weekend and next. Spectrum West, the program that deals with the music and the arts and the culture of Western Wisconsin. Good to have you along. Let's begin with this weekend's activity. The Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra presents Discover the Great Symphony Saturday evening at the State Theater. And the Master Singers begin their season on Sunday afternoon. The symphony event features works by Beethoven, Bruckner, and Schubert, specifically his, Schubert's, Symphony No. 9 in C Major, also called the Great Symphony. It's also part of the name of the concert, Discover the Great Symphony. As you see, it all goes together. I stopped in to see Maestro Nobu Yasuda at his university office, wondering about Mr. Schubert and his ego.
Did Schubert give that the name? Does he have that big of an ego and every other symphony's just good? Or what's going on with Schubert there?
No, I mean, many people know, I mean, of course, you know, Schubert was a great composer, and also, I mean, you know, his music is loved, you know, many people listen to 8 symphonies. Actually, he wrote 8 symphonies, but we are performing 9th symphony.
That doesn't make sense to me. I don't like math, and that doesn't add up to
me. I know, there are so many, actually, kind of interesting thing about, actually, the number of symphonies. Because now it's known as a 9th symphony, but when you visit, actually, the maybe 100 years ago, this was labeled as a 7th symphony. 8th symphony is unfinished symphony. Okay, so the very, very famous unfinished symphony is number 8. So then I'm still kind of musicologist, you know, kind of argues, you know. So this great symphony, was it actually composed before this 8th symphony or after? And many people actually thought that, you know, this great symphony was composed after 8th symphony. And I don't know why it became 9, because it means that 7 was empty, right? So I don't know about the historical reason why number 7 was open. But many times, actually many years ago, it was believed to be this was composed before number 8. So then actually the music still is published as a number 7. But it is actually called a Great 9th Symphony.
And why is it called the Great Symphony?
It's great. the 9th. Because this Schubert Great Symphony, I mean, 9th Symphony is, I mean, great symphony, in my opinion. But not many people knows about this. This, you know, manuscript, actually, the, you know, of the symphony was buried, actually, on the desk of the Schubert for a long time. Mm. And then, actually, you know, Beethoven died 1827. And Schubert died a year later, 1828. And many people think that, you know, like Beethoven, Schubert, Schumann, Mendelssohn, Brahms, Wagner, kind of lived in during the same kind of a period, but they don't know exactly which came first. Schumann was already living, but he was not even writing a major music. Mendelssohn was alive, but he was not even writing a major music. Brahms actually was born 1833. So now my point is that Schubert, this symphony, when you listen to this symphony, you will hear, oh, this passage sounds like a Schumann. Oh, this absolutely sounds like a Mendelssohn. Wow, this sounds like Brahms. Wow, sometimes even, you know, sounds like a Bruckner or Wagner. And you might think, oh, Schubert maybe stole those, you know, great composers, you know, symphonic idea. No. Answer is no. Schubert wrote this piece before, way before these famous great composers actually became a composer. So then actually, you know, this symphony was not even performed.
So here's what went down. Schubert died young. His brother met Schumann and gave him the Schubert manuscripts, including the Great Symphony. Schumann sent it to Mendelssohn. Later, Brahms got it, edited it, and published it. So these great composers, including probably Bruckner and Wagner, studied the score, and I think that's the kind way of saying it. Beethoven's 9th was famous, but it was Schubert who opened the door to this kind of romantic symphony. And Saturday night, the symphony plays the Great Symphony, music
on a grand scale.
And actually, I really, really want to introduce this great piece to this community, to our audience. So I want you to come to experience this.
Well, that's cool. What a great story. I didn't expect that. And for the record, Schubert really wanted to be like Beethoven. He loved his music, and so the symphony's also performing a Beethoven number Saturday. In fact, there's also a reason there's a Bruckner piece in the repertoire.
Another piece I chose in the program is a Bruckner. It's an overture. It's called a G minor overture. Mm-hmm. It was actually not really Bruckner's major piece, but because he was still a student, you know, when he wrote this piece. However, the reason why I chose this Bruckner piece was that Beethoven was Schubert's inspiration. Bruckner became the future of the Schubert. Mm. That's the one kind of reason I kind of thought Schubert became the kind of foundation of lots of romantic music, symphonic music, you know, to come.
So, as you can see, they don't just throw darts at a wall full of sheet music. There are reasons behind the choices they make just for you.
Music is not all about, you know, try to show off myself or any, just create something, you know, obscure. No, music has to communicate with people.
So it's important for the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra to communicate with people.
Yes, because I want to make sure that they understand the real meaning of the composition and the real message of the composers.
There you go. Now you know how much the symphony cares about not only what it does, but how it does it. Saturday evening, the State Theater, tickets at 832-6366 and online at cvsymphony.org and at the door. Thanks to Nobu for spending time with us here on Spectrum West and explaining some important stuff. And then Sunday afternoon at 2, the Master Singers begin their 21st year, and director Gary Schwartzoff's office door was also open the other day.
One of the milestones in everyone's life is when they turn 21. It's where life gets fun. We make that turn from adolescence to maturity. The Master Singers are 21 this year. Are you having fun?
We've come of age, have we not, at 21? Yes, there is that rite of passage in life. I remember that myself a few years ago. Yes, it's an exciting season. It's our usual three concerts in the mix this year. The third concert added sometime after we started, I'm not sure what year that was the fall concert with really an interest in trying to, yes, focus on American choral composers and also to do secular music. That's the nature of that fall concert, that it could be secular choral music as the others focus seasonal on Christmas, obviously, around the concept of lesson carols, the English concept. And then Easter is typically, yes, around the Easter theme. This year we're doing a new Requiem by Dan Forrest. Requiem for the Living will be the centerpiece of that concert.
Does the fall concert, well, first of all, it's nice that it's the first one of the season because that sort of gets you guys going. But secondly, because it's American music, it's Americana, and a lot of times you are doing exciting new things that I don't hear from other choirs or choruses. There are so many wonderful harmonies, and it's spellbinding.
Well, hopefully that's what the audience will hear this year when they come from such American choral composers as Norman Della Gioia, who is certainly one of the major figures of the 20th century, to arrangements of songs, of lyrics that people know, words of Robert Burns, for example, "Oh, My Love's Like a Red, Red Rose." Mm-hmm. Norman Luboff, who with his choir was so popular in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, to new people, new composers such as Richard Waters on a lovely text. We're doing two pieces by area composers who are doing great work and very exciting. Bethany Meyer from Minneapolis, St. Paul, Love is Alive, composer in residence again this year with Andrew Steffen. Andrew's writing a piece for each of the three concerts. This fall, he chose a text by Sarah Teasdale, I Am Not Yours. In addition to that, you know, Morton Lordson is one of America's great composers in the 21st century, along with Eric Whitaker, James Mulholland, Z. Randall Stroop, and David Dickow. Many of these are Midwestern composers.
And you do things by them because the stuff that they write fits you, or because we're back to that, they're exciting?
Well, they're exciting. They are the mainstays of the choral repertoire of our day. And as I said, we're interested in the next chapter with Bethany Meyer and Andrew Steffens being new composers to the medium as well.
Now, Sunday's concert, you have some guests. Tell us about that.
Well, we're pleased to welcome Women's Chorus from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Dr. Elizabeth Patio is the conductor of this group. There are six choirs here at the university, and this ensemble, I like inviting them to this concert for. It gives them an opportunity for a Sunday afternoon performance and for their parents and family friends to come as well.
Uh-huh. You're so involved in so many things. Does every year get better in your association with the Master Singers?
Well, I suppose you would have to ask the members of the Master Singers that, to be fair. You know, I started this in 1992 because I felt like there was the need for outreach from this office, from my position here at the university. I oftentimes refer to the choirs here on campus as being the farm team for the Master Singers. There are an increasing number of students who have graduated from here who are still in the area that perform with the Master Singers, and that's exciting to see, for there are a few members who have been in the Master Singers the 21 years I've had them, and they, like myself, can't do this forever, so it's nice to see new blood coming into the ensemble.
Talk just briefly about how much is involved in putting on a concert, not just from your perspective, but it's a big commitment to be a Master Singer.
It is a big commitment, and hats off to the ensemble members and their families for the sacrifice here in doing this. It is an automatic process. It takes time for them to be together, not just simply to learn the notes, but to move beyond that. I mean, we've been ready, I think, with the notes and rhythms and et cetera for probably a couple weeks now, but there are numerous languages here. There's Italian, Spanish. It takes a while for that to become part of our aesthetic, if you would. We've had some diction coaches that this particular concert brought in. It is a time-consuming process, and for the fall and the Christmas concert, we're doing recordings of these CDs, so that's another thing that drives, I think, the excellence within the ensemble to try and get it right and to move beyond the mechanics.
Gary Schwartzoff, remember, 2 p.m. Sunday, First Lutheran Church, Oxford Avenue, Eau Claire. Megan Koolig from TV 13 is the narrator, The Marvelous Master Singers. Tickets at Morgan Music, Schmidt Music, First Congregational Church, and at the door, the website is themastersingers.net. There's a big concert next Friday from the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. We have that scoop and their special guest, plus the Chippewa Valley Book Fest and John Greendeer, Ho-Chunk president, when Spectrum West continues.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery in a local and fair trade gallery. Details at simply-dunn.com. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Music from Beethoven, Bruckner, and Schubert is featured in the concert Discover the Great Symphony, Saturday, October 12th at the State Theater. Details at 832-6366 or at cvsymphony.org. And support comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering the Wisconsin mobile app in Android, iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch for checking balances, paying bills, and more. Mobile banking demo, app, and details at wisconsincu.org.
Next Friday, the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra welcomes some special guests, all of whom have experienced or are experiencing some of their education in western Wisconsin. Andy Neasley came here from the Milwaukee suburb of Glendale, graduated in 2003, the recipient of a first-class education within the hallowed halls of UW-Eau Claire. He's gone on to some impressive performance and application of his trade as a trumpet player. The other guests are musicians from three area high schools. To talk about it all, we were lucky to get Jeff Peterson of the Jazz Orchestra in the studio and Mr. Neasley on the phone from New York, all at the same time. What's the history between you two guys?
Let's see. When did we first hang out, Jeff?
Oh, I think you actually wrote some stuff for us before I'd ever even met you. You did a couple of charts for us, I think, back in 2010, but we didn't actually meet until... Was it 2012? I think it was fall of 2012 is when I was in New York, and that's actually the first time we met.
That's right. You came out here for a conference.
Right.
And we met for a beer or two to talk about what we could do together with the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra.
Yep.
Well, that's cool. And you've been buddies ever since.
Indeed. You know, anybody that I think I've known throughout the years from Eau Claire, from the Chippewa Valley, they always become fast friends.
Well, we know everything there is to know about Jeff because he's been on the show before. professor and, you know, department chair,
oh,
political
God.
Science department. But and you know what? Because of the way things are today in government, I wish we were talking political science a little bit, not much.
I'm glad we're not for once.
Yeah,
that's all
well,
I'm going to say.
And the bottom line to that is I just don't have time to do that. But not having enough time reminds me that we're talking about all the stuff Andy has his fingers in. Started on the violin, so you can tell I read about you. Discovered the trumpet, subsequently jazz. Glendale.
I definitely identify pretty closely with Glendale, but Milwaukee as a whole, too. Most of my friends that I grew up with, whether it was in the music business or just socially via Glendale, I'm really still very close with, as I am with so many of my friends from my time in Eau Claire. I really think I suppose we can all speak to this, but like the kind of upbringing we have in Wisconsin really builds a bond to home base. And that's couldn't it be more evident in the last decade I've spent in New York, because there's been a ton of people that I play gigs with out here that, you know, I either went to school with in Eau Claire or we find some kind of common bond. And those will be a lot of the people that, you'll wind up calling for subs or you'll call for a gig or whatnot, because the vibe is always really, really positive and really, really fun. One of the ensembles I lead here in New York is made up of probably there's probably four or five Wisconsinites in the band. And we all met each other kind of by happenstance. It wasn't like it was a planned thing, like let's get a bunch of Wisconsin guys together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was doing a recording session for a band a couple years ago, and it just turns out that the engineer on the session was from Madison and played bass, and he lived with his roommate, who was also from Madison, you know, that we all decided, you know, to form a band a few years later.
Did Glendale have a good music program? Is that where the real love of music started for you, or did that blossom once you got to Eau Claire?
I'd say a little bit of both. My father is a professional tuba player in Milwaukee. He's been a member of the Milwaukee Ballet Orchestra as a tuba player, I think, since the orchestra's inception, quite a long time. He's been playing Nutcracker for 30-some years. And my mother was an elementary school music teacher for about 37 years.
So it's in your genes there.
Yeah, there was no escaping it. I probably would have started playing trumpet a little earlier, but back then they didn't start kids playing brass instruments that early because of the development of the muscles in the face and whatnot.
What you did, though, is you started me thinking about ballet and tuba. I didn't know that they went together.
Well, he plays tuba in the orchestra. He doesn't dance.
Well, it's a mental picture that's still going around. So tell me how your love of music blossomed at UW Eau Claire. What was that experience like?
Where do I start? I was there for more years than my degree than I probably should have been. But you know what? I have to talk about Mr. Baca first off. He was a real mentor to me, was and is, through all the trumpet lessons and through all the jazz playing via Mr. Baca. I think that's where I certainly developed my first exposure to some real writing for big band. You know, there was a ton of opportunity in Eau Claire back then as there is now. There's probably a ton more now. But I really wanted to get my hands in anything I could, knowing that down the line, you know, every little skill that you had in the business could possibly mean a bigger paycheck or another gig.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of opportunity to, you know, write for the jazz ensemble there. And
cool.
So I kind of dug into that pretty quickly. You know, there's so much opportunity to practice when you're that young, which is something that, you know, now that I'm in my 30s, I wish I could go back to my 20s and have 8 hours a day to practice.
That's an interesting wish. Way to go.
Yeah. I mean, I get enough time these days, but you get older, life happens, and, you know, I've got 10 charts to write, and I've got four instruments I want to practice.
Mm-hmm. Something about those little practice rooms, too, that kind of grow on you.
Oh, indeed. One of the hats I wear here in New York is working at the Manhattan School of Music, where I did my graduate studies. So I still have a lot of exposure to the kind of motivation and creativity that can be fostered in a tiny practice room. So there's plenty of times when I'll go over to school,
yeah,
a little a little early and, you know, hit the practice room over there to kind of rekindle that kind of motivation.
Our guest on the phone, Andy Neasley, UW-Eau Claire grad composer. He plays the trumpet, piano, and violin, writes, produces music. He's an art designer. I found out he's even a DJ once in a while, folks. So if you got a wedding coming up, you might want to call it. The Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra is playing at the State Theater, 7:30 p.m. October 18th, appearing with some high school bands as well. Also with us in the studio, Jeff Peterson of the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra, drummer guy. Jeff, this concert seems like it's quite a natural. It's kind of a combination reunion and premiere, isn't it?
Well, it is. And it, in many ways, this is something that Andy and I have talked about almost since we very first started working together. His writing is at a level that is just perfect for our band. He does things that challenge us but don't overwhelm us, which is exactly what we're looking for. He put together our version of the Hallelujah Chorus for our Christmas concert last year that was just an enormous hit. People absolutely loved it. And so we've been conspiring on trying to figure out a way to get him back here for, I'm going to say, 2.5 years at this point.
Wow.
And luckily, we were able to both Xcel Energy and Visit Eau Claire were willing to help us so that we can bring Andy back for an entire week. So he'll be here work with all the high school kids. He'll be working with each of the bands a couple of times. He's also going to be doing a master class over at the university on composing and arranging. So it's a chance to really take full advantage of his talent and bring him back to the area.
So I missed a word. It's reunion, premiere, and culmination.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it.
Of a week's work. So having high school bands play with you is makes even more sense now that I hear the whole picture.
Absolutely.
Andy, is it easy or tough to write specifically for a concert? When you get the commission, do you get a little nervous or do you just say, oh, man, I've had that rolling around in my head for a long time?
I think it's a little bit of both. I've always got, you know, 10 ideas that are in my head or filed away in a file somewhere that I wasn't able to develop maybe at that time. But then there's also, you know, experiences when you get down to a deadline and sometimes creativity pops and sometimes it doesn't and you figure out a way to get it out of your system, I guess. You know, there's all sorts of tricks that I'll use. You know, maybe I'll go out for a walk instead of sitting in my apartment, you know, get the blood flowing.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I'll sit down with 10 records that I absolutely adore and try to find some inspiration. What I've been doing a lot lately is going back to one of my first loves of big band, which was a Joe Henderson big band CD from 1997, I think.
Huh.
One of the first inspirational things. Back in 1997, there was a lot of stuff in that record and many other records that my ears weren't quite ready to understand or comprehend in so much as being able to write on my own. And now I find 15 years later that a lot of that has sunk in, and now that I can easily apply a lot of the concepts that maybe I heard on that record or another record. So in regards to this concert, when you're given the restraints of writing for a particular group or even writing for a high school, it kind of helps narrow down the focus, and I can take some of these, you know, really advanced kind of concepts and whittle them into something that's really musical. It's going to be a ton of fun. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while. I'll be able to play with a bunch of old friends, make some new friends, and we're going to make a ton of really great music.
No kidding. So what's on the program next Friday, Jeff?
Well, we've got three high schools coming in to play with us. Regis will be joining us, Chippewa Catholic, and Eau Claire North.
Okay.
And they'll all be playing some of their own music as well as the music that Andy has written for them. And then we're doing essentially the entire second half of the show. Andy has concocted several interesting new charts for us. You know, it's one of the things that's been interesting for us is we're not a band that has typically done a lot of Afro-Cuban Latin music before, not necessarily because we don't like it, but we just haven't been there.
And, do you have the rhythm for it?
Well, it turns out we do, which was a really pleasant surprise to discover. So Andy's given us some really fun stuff to do, a couple of charts that are clearly in the vein of the work he's done with Bobby Sanabria and his Afro-Cuban band. And yeah, it's going to be a blast. I think we've got a good selection of stuff. We've got some great soloists. Andy's going to take some solos with us, too, and we should have a lot of fun.
Andy Neasley, thanks so much for giving us a call. We appreciate it. And safe travels. Jeff Peterson, thanks for being with us here on Spectrum West. Have fun at the concert. Hopefully it's jam-packed.
I hope so, too.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Little Bobby Sanabria in the background. The concert is next Friday, October 18th, State Theater. Give yourself something special. Details at chippewajazz.org. Here's a Spectrum memo. Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. in Schofield Auditorium at UW-Eau Claire, the Schneider Disability Issues Forum features author, veteran, and disabilities advocate Captain Luis Carlos Montalban. And Tuesday, the Golden Retriever Who Saved His Life. It's a book festival event, and good friend Dr. Catherine Schneider and colleagues are responsible for making the forum an annual success. A reception will follow in the Dakota Ballroom of Davies Center. This is the weekend of the Western Wisconsin Pottery Tour, Saturday and Sunday in and around River Falls. Four sites and 14 artisans. Details at westernwisconsinpotterytour.com. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. It's wonderful having you along. And it's time for the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. This is the 14th annual event, and given today's various ways of reading, maybe they should consider calling it the Reading Festival, since books are continuously being replaced by more streamlined means of soaking up the written word. Doug Pearson is a retired English mentor from UW-Eau Claire, a natural fit as a senior member of the Book Fest crew, and reading was the topic that began our conversation just the other day. Is it a prerequisite in order to teach English? You have to be a prolific reader?
Yeah.
I love to read. I never read fiction. I only read things that teach me something.
Well, see, that's one of the points that we've been struggling with.
I don't read for entertainment, I guess. I read for information.
Right. And a lot of readers do. I've got a lot of friends who read only history or only biography. We've got about four fiction writers this time around. I think every one of them is interesting and has written a surprising novel. We've got a mystery writer we've had before, Mary Logue. Do you know that name?
Yeah, she's been on this show. Yeah.
Mary's not only a good writer, but she's also a good teacher. Okay. So when she comes, she talks about not only what she does and reads from her work, but she talks about the world of mystery writing. When she was here the last time, she and her husband gave a little seminar on how you write a mystery story. And this time she's talking about two categories of mystery writing, the cozy and the hard-boiled. I guess the cozy is Agatha Christie and the hard-boiled is Sam Spade, you know, Dashiell Hammett.
I would guess as an English teacher, mentor, professor, one of your joys had to be when you were able to see someone blossom as a reader.
Yes, although you don't always see it. I find that I learn about it from some of my students years later. They don't tell you that they're getting much out of it. Sometimes you can see it on their faces. You can see it in what they write. But it's not always clear the extent to which they've absorbed it in their souls and that's important to them. I had a person come up to me a couple months ago. I hadn't seen this guy in 35 years, and he said, "I remember this poem that you taught," and that really turned me on to literature. He was a lawyer. He had no reason necessarily to sustain an interest in that, but he did.
Yeah, yeah. Reading is one of those things, you know. You sometimes have this fear that it's going by the wayside, even though there are a lot of, I mean, people are reading in different ways. They're reading on electronic things.
Now, they're still reading.
I like the feeling of opening a book in my lap and holding it and setting it on the nightstand and that kind of stuff. And then you have suspicions that maybe it isn't being done because then you find out how ill-informed people are when election time comes.
Yeah.
You know, the reading of newspapers and the reading of biographies and position papers.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about reading and reading critically. Reading critically requires attention and thinking, and I think a lot of us are so harried that we read more lazily. But if you're reading a piece of fiction, for example, or maybe even some poetry, although few people do read poetry anymore, I think you might just be looking for an escape. I mean, I think a lot of literary reading is read that way, not analytically.
I've had that conversation with poets, whether they believe people get more out of a poem reading it or hearing it. Some people are turned on to poetry by hearing a poet and may not have ever had the same reaction had they read it themselves.
I think that's right. You know, we have three poets in the book festival this year, one of whom is the Wisconsin State Poet Laureate, Max Garland.
Yeah, good guy. Yeah.
Great guy. And when he reads his poetry, I think people who hate poetry or never read it or have never read it or never enjoyed it in school are just turned on because his poetry is accessible, but he's got a wonderful imagination, great management of language.
Sometimes poets can trick you. Was that a poem?
Right.
Yeah, that was a poem. I like that.
Well, that's partly to do with the fact that poetry has changed a lot.
Yes, it has.
Poetry is now more a matter of rhythm. And although sound is very important in it, rhyme is less important. And a lot of people come to poetry thinking it has to rhyme or it isn't a poem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, they're right about one thing. The music of a poem is important, but rhyme isn't the only music in the poem. So they may feel that they didn't hear a poem, but they liked what they heard.
Uh-huh. See, this is an example, folks, of what happens when I sit down with interesting people. I end up talking about things that are way off the topic, but it's not really off the topic because our subject is the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. It happens the 14th through the 20th. Doug Pearson is our guest, and in talking with Doug prior to opening up the microphones, I found out that he's been involved for quite a while, but not at the first one. He was involved in the second one, and I kidded him about saying, oh, so you let other people do the hard work and then dove in after. How's the 14th going to compare to the first and second?
It's grown enormously in significant ways. Let's just take an example. In the second and third year, I think there were perhaps a dozen people who planned and put the thing together. This year, there are close to 100 people involved as volunteers in various aspects of the operation. In the second year, we had one library contact. That was the Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library here in Eau Claire. Now we have had five or six in the last two or three years, five this year, area libraries. And I don't remember exactly what our donor contributions were in the second and third year. They were not tremendously significant. We were fortunate to get some grants that helped us put it together. Now we have a huge list of donors, many partners, the schools, the Chippewa Valley Museum, the libraries that I mentioned, and a lot of business partners or business supporters, and a tremendous number of just individual people who send in some money. One other difference, somehow that small group of planners in the second and third year put together a festival that lasted about 2 weeks. Mm. And after, I think it was the third one, maybe the fourth one, the planning group said, this is hopeless.
Let's downsize this.
Yeah. So we've tried to go to 3 days. We can't do it. We end up with a week-long event.
Which is a happy medium, it sounds like. Uh-huh. I guess I'm interested in your take, being a retired English professor, principal in the book festival, and one who touches authors in a special way, and that is the abundance of materials to read nowadays. I mean,
it's amazing, isn't it?
I wonder whether that doesn't dilute a person's perspective on what's out there to read, what's good. How do they know what's good? Who do I believe?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that's especially difficult, but I don't think it matters that much. Reading is reading.
You'll know whether you like something.
Well, you'll know whether you like it, but eventually you'll know also whether you think it's any good. If you haven't been reading very much for very long, you don't have much to go on, but your own instincts are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take the opportunity to read widely, you'll find out more. If, for example, I have a number of friends who only read mysteries. Well, the abundance of mystery writers and of books is overwhelming. So how do you choose? Some say alphabetically. And I don't know how you choose. You choose by what you read about. There are usually reviews out there, librarian recommendations. Some readers just cultivate one or six writers, and that's it. They just keep hoping that that writer will turn out another one.
Familiarity with authors is a good way to keep going with some consistency as well.
Right.
But then you have to jump off that barge and get your feet wet.
Well, that's
elsewhere.
What the book festival is about. One of our major goals is to introduce new writers to the community of readers in Eau Claire. And we do it not only with the major programming of adult writers, but we do it even with our last event in the book festival is on Sunday, when we celebrate in a showcase 24 young writers, third through eighth graders. Mm-hmm. So we're saying writing is happening everywhere. Children are writing, young adults are writing. We ought to celebrate that and hear what they have to say. There's four writers in each grade level, two selected for poetry and two selected for prose.
And those young writers will also benefit from the book festival because they have workshops involved.
They do, yeah. There's a workshop, in fact, aimed at the young child from grade 2 to 6 at the Chippewa Valley Museum on Saturday morning with John Coy. And then for teens and adults, Kathy Giorgio, who's reading on Saturday morning and then following her reading with a workshop, will be assisting writers who want to know more about how to approach a writing problem.
It is Monday through Sunday. Five area libraries are hosting, as well as locations all over the valley. There are poetry readings. There's also a lunch and a dinner.
Maybe to interrupt just a moment here and point out that everything in the program is free except the lunch and the dinner.
Well,
and you need
sense,
to reserve at the Ellie Phillips Library.
All of this, as you mentioned earlier, impossible without grants and donations. And you have in your booklet 2 pages of people who have been generous enough to be a part of the book festival. All the questions you may have can be answered by going to the website, and it is cvbookfest.org. Well, Doug, thanks so much for being with us. This book fest is important for a lot of reasons, I think many of which we've already touched on. And thanks for being involved in it, and keep up the great work. I mean, it really is great work. This is an impressive affair.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll pass this along to the many people who are making it happen.
Well, hopefully they're all listening.
Let's hope so, too.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Again, the website is cvbookfest.org. Too much information, too many fine authors, and too many events to list here. Go online, pick and choose to your heart's content. It all starts officially on Monday. This is Spectrum West.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making grocery shopping easier for all shoppers with the introduction of pink, yellow, and green boomerang buy tags throughout the store. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company. Support also comes from Visit Winona, where lake and river water trails provide the opportunity to glide, paddle, and drift through the fall. Visit Winona.com. This is the year to discover Winona's outdoors.
Spectrum Memo, the 2013 Flyway Film Festival, is around the corner October 17th through 20th in Stockholm and Pepin. Over 50 films shown in 2 venues. Filmmakers and industry professionals on hand. Info at flywayfilmfestival.org. The Ho-Chunk Nation is a neighbor of ours in many places of Wisconsin, and as such, it's always nice to get to know your neighbors rather than simply driving in the garage, closing the door before you exit the car, and hanging out on your backyard deck most of the time. The Ho-Chunk, as represented by their president, John Greendeer, recently committed to an arrangement with UW Eau Claire designed to enhance prospects for collaboration between both entities, give and take and flourish. I placed a call to President Greendeer's office in Black River Falls.
How you doing, Al?
I'm doing fine. Glad to get you to sit down for just a few minutes. Kind of like to get to know the Ho-Chunk a bit better. I was surprised, actually, and saddened, frankly, to read about what the people of the Big Voice, as you're called, endured over the last century and three quarters. But it's your most recent history that spells some of the most fundamental changes. Next year marks the 20th anniversary of constitutional revisions and a movement to make sure you were being referred to by the name you yourselves have always used. And that brings me to this. Have the last 20 years been groundbreaking for the Ho-Chunk in many more ways than just, you know, the constructive type groundbreakings we're all accustomed to?
Just a little background. I come from the political science field, more fascinated by the older stuff, the early Western political theory and thought, and kind of a dark secret that I know most of what we do seems groundbreaking, but if you actually read the works of those early philosophers and contributors, it's really not new. But in terms of how it applies contemporarily, when you look at a tribal government versus other governments per se, I can sit here with great comfort and say that I've never gone into a more sophisticated government structure, more contemporary government structure than I've seen at any county, local, state, or federal government.
Wow.
We're absolutely ahead of the game in all those, and I say that proudly, not arrogantly.
Mm-hmm.
We have really adapted to not only a governing structure, but also the infrastructure that supports it. So as much as we come in to work to complain about work and how far behind we are, we're actually pretty dang good out there. Yeah.
Yeah, and you must feel the foundation, though, upon which what you're talking about sits, because, you know, I mean, you have all of those people whose stick-to-itiveness and courage and everything, you know, was evident years ago to thank for all that.
Absolutely. You know, certainly our culture doesn't allow for the canonization or the glorification of accomplishment, just a steady move forward. Again, the word adaptation will often and always come out in order, you know, to me to say that we've always taken what we've had and made it better. We've always taken what somebody else has had and made it better. But we've been very progressive. And, of course, the pillars of the foundation of our government, we celebrated this year on March 19th, to be specific, on the date. The celebration was actually June 22nd, I believe, of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
But on March 19th in 1963 is when the federal government recognized our original constitution. So that was 50 years. So we've gone through so many different changes and not only the government structure type, but also the people as well. So it's kind of unique to see where we are in terms of the 566 federally recognized tribes in the United States, where our position is. It's well up there.
Uh-huh. A bit about your presidency, elected position.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Term?
4 years.
Okay, so it's as we might have imagined. There are 5 legislative districts encompassing all 72 counties in our state. One district includes tribal members not living in Wisconsin. I'm guessing, and I think I've read about many of them, your duties are many. What kinds of things are your constituents telling you today, especially the young people? I mean, are they optimistic?
Well, that's a very good question. In those 5 districts are several different communities, and each community is unique in itself. What can get you a standing ovation in one community can probably get you ostracized out of the other. Not as polarized, but it's very important that as a president that you're a president of all districts.
Sure.
And that you're a president of all Ho-Chunk people, whether the belief system, whether it's age that you choose to identify folks, whether it's education levels, whether it's demographics. So, you know, when you speaking about the young people, that's a big focus. And I think it's unfortunate that we're this far in our society where we actually find the solution of all of our problems lying within the younger generation. So whether it's language revitalization, whether it's developing core value for education, pre-K through 12 through up to post-secondary higher education, you know, I think the focus is slowly gearing down toward the youth and providing them a lot of, you know, enrichment opportunities so that we can see ourselves in the future of that. So we have been focusing on, you know, providing support structures for education. You know, I'm using a lot of government speak here.
Sure.
in educational facilities, but on the other side, you know, this is where our language is taught for a lot of individuals who have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to sound like I'm campaigning, but you know, they are our future, and there's a lot of substance behind that. You know, we tend to think generationally. So we look at our children as the people that are going to be taking care of us when we're older,
right,
taking care of those grandchildren as we do today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the curiosity was because young people notoriously can't wait to bolt from things that are longstanding and historical. So I was wondering how they are grasping, you know, the heritage that is theirs.
Well, we certainly got a new demographic with the younger Ho-Chunk, with the younger child, any of any background, you know, with the proliferation of social media and Facebook and contacts and things like that. We are older folks. I'm not that old, but you have to be a little trendier and savvier and open to the technology that is in front of us if we are going to ever bridge that communication between us and the youngsters. So certainly, you know, while we're running around talking about websites and things like that, you know, that's even starting to run through its obsolescence, and so we have to stay ahead of the game in order to keep the interest of and the eagerness to learn with our children, so that they can come and be invited into a cultural way of life, a political way of life. Because this may be is very likely going to be where they're at, but this is, you know, they're us again. I don't want to make that distinction between on age. They are simply us.
Yeah, and I guess I was unaware of how much a part of your heritage, education, teaching, and learning has been for so long. That was really neat to read. John Greendeer, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation, with us on Spectrum West. John, I printed and read the history and the districts, statistics, government services, enterprises. Of all the services available to tribal members, housing, education, labor, health, social, veterans, and more, the one that sticks out for me is what we've been talking about, I guess, touching on it anyway, heritage preservation. Is that one that sticks out for you, too?
Absolutely. This is probably the most difficult area to command, because, you know, if you take, and this was a discussion I had with folks, you know, what do you think of when I say cultural resources? Mm-hmm. Someone might get the illustration of a traditional feast going on or traditional meeting taking place or a gathering or something like that. Others may consider cultural resources as working with repatriation and gravesites, archaeology, you know, data. And so, you know, it starts to, without a direct focus, you know, some may also look at it as education, you know, teachers going out, teaching the kinship system, the language system. And so it really is, heritage preservation is such a broad field that, you know, some people might put reliance on it and expectations over an area because it's not covering all those bases.
Sure.
So it is a very very complex word when you actually overanalyze it, but it's got a major responsibility. You know, sometimes we, adapting to our own government, see the government as teaching us our language, seeing the government as supporting our higher education needs and taking care of our social services needs. But the government might not always be there for that, especially in areas of culture. So I, you know, and this might be in dispute, but I don't see the government and the programming the solution for lost languages and lost culture. I believe it is a profound support mechanism, and it's a very valued privilege that we have that, but ultimately there's no magic pill to teach you the language and teach you the culture other than providing that as a resource and making sure that we have access and availability to those individuals who understand and can bring that history forward to contemporary terms. So yes, it is a very big part, and you know, it gets a bit cryptic sometimes in terms of, you know, what direction it's going to go, but it's very important. That's what's going to define us in the future.
You took a big first step recently with officials from UW-Eau Claire committing to the intention of collaborating with the university. Tell us about that objective from your perspective.
Well, thank you. Well, what a unique, groundbreaking event. Prior to this, you know, when things come along in concept, as they often do, mm-hmm. we're not short of good ideas. I'll tell you that right now, Al.
Okay.
We have a lot of good ideas and a lot of well-intended endeavors. There's always those obstacles that jump out in front: time, money, resources. However, what we have here with UW-Eau Claire is basically a hand extended by this university to open the door and bring some of those conceptuals to real life and put some real support behind it. You just don't get a chancellor stepping out of their office to, you know, roll their sleeves up and become involved in this. You just don't get a president, an executive director, a couple executive directors coming out to roll their sleeves up on something like this at this stage of development. But a lot of meetings have taken place, many of which resulted in a broadening of this vision of the Ho-Chunk Nation actually embarking on its first steps toward eventually having its own college
sure.
campus.
Oh, wow,
and
cool.
it can't happen without UW-Eau Claire or a university system. And so this is profound. It's exciting. I think it's well supported, very well supported. And unfortunately, it's essential nowadays in order to stimulate the drive for post-secondary higher education and take in consideration all of the factors that prevent an individual from coming to campus, such as child care, such as income, such as availability, access, transportation, to take all those things and try to inoculate some of those barriers and say, well, if those are your issues, we've got the perfect school for you.
Yeah.
So this is really a very exciting event that, you know, I'm glad I'm a part of.
I'll bet. Yeah, and let's hope it turns out to be a really well-paved two-way street, because that's, I think, how it's designed. I mean, I'm excited about your opportunities presented by this, but also, you know, acquainting others and cooperating with your culture and your tradition. And that's all good stuff. That's probably long overdue, and good on you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Spectrum West deals with the arts and music and culture and humanities of Western Wisconsin. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this particular topic, but I'm hoping that in the future we can also incorporate some of what is in our title, you know, the arts and the music and more of the culture of the Ho-Chunk Nation, because after all, we're close neighbors.
Excellent.
That'd be great. Mr. President, been a pleasure. All the best to you professionally and personally, and to all the citizens of what is a proud and progressive Ho-Chunk Nation. All the best.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ross.
Mr. Ross, wow.
My mom and dad always taught me to be polite.
Mine too. Wow. That was a lot of fun. John Greendeer, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation, congratulations. And congratulations as well to UW-Eau Claire for the vision. We'll keep you posted. Don't forget, Friday evening, it's Claude Bourbon. Maybe sometimes they call him Bourbon. Guest guitarist extraordinaire at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. That should be fun. Next week, we're going to sit around the farm table that's about to become a Wisconsin Public Television special. It's right under your nose. The Woodturners return for their annual exhibition, some books about the challenges of old age, and a lot more. Thanks, Rachel Vick and Tiffany Coggins, for prep support. Thank you all for being with us and making Spectrum West possible. By the way, Jim Oliver is doing fine and will return soon. Al Ross here. Thanks again. Have a great weekend.